Well, good morning. Thanks for coming. This is probably my last Blue Jones breakfast, so sorry. See you later, alligator. It's been great. And I was thinking about Lou. I just was going through and throwing out old stuff, and it's been like 15 years, so or close. So we definitely miss him, and I think he would be proud of what we put together in his honor. I know his family. My really good friend is friends with his was friends with him and is still in touch with his family, and they were very, very touched that we kept a seminar going in his honor. So I'm pleased that we were able to do it, and you'll just have to stay tuned. There is discussion in the wind about possibly not having it at 8:30 in the morning, because in the beginning, that was when we had Chapter 13 Day and everybody was coming to court on Tuesday mornings. It made sense because you were all coming down here anyway. But now we do so much by phone and so many things settle. Yay, keep that up. So there's not the same kind of
mass.
Right. So we're talking possibly doing a lunch program or something like that. So stay tuned. It'll all be posted on our website in the biker listserv. But I want to thank everybody who stuck with it and came and made it so successful. And I really think we had a lot of great programs and a lot of good networking and camaraderie was established. And that was my goal for it. So I'm glad it happened. And I thank everybody for doing it. And today's speakers, Adam Tutai.
Yes.
And Garrett Sobolewski, who was Judge Helfinger's law clerk way back when. So they're going to talk to us about Wisconsin business entities, what bankruptcy practitioners need to know. So without further ado, thank you very much for presenting, and take it away.
Thank you, Judge. As Judge indicated, my name is Adam Tutai. I primarily practice in corporate and tax law at Meisner, Tierney, Fisher & Nichols. My general experience with bankruptcy is explaining the automatic stay and voidable preferences to unpaid and increasingly irritated clients, whereas Garrett is sort of my nuts and bolts bankruptcy expert. Today we're going to cover going through the list of most common Wisconsin business entities, primarily from the standpoint of what limited liability they afford to the members, officers, directors, as well as talk about governance and fiduciary duty issues, as these are the areas which often find their way into the bankruptcy courts as matters of discussion, typically for creditors or trustees seeking to pierce the veil, go after officers and directors for prior misconduct and the like. On the first page, we see a chart there of the most common entities here. Really, for Wisconsin, the only one that's probably missing would be cooperatives, would probably be another very common Wisconsin form, which we don't address here today, and that's largely due to our strong agricultural and cheese making and brew making businesses. But the main entity forms are the general partnership, which also includes the limited liability partnership that's governed by Chapter 178, the limited partnership, which we'll cover the difference between those, but that's governed by a separate chapter, that's 179. We have Wisconsin business corporations under Chapter 180, and that includes a couple special subsections for the statutory close corporation and the service corporation, all under Chapter 180. We also have Chapter 181, which deals primarily with non-stock corporations, most commonly used for nonprofit endeavors, but technically can be used for for-profit enterprises as well. Chapter 183, one of the more popular forms nowadays, is the limited liability company. And then new from 2017, I think, is the benefit corporation, or section Chapter 204. So as we go through here, first thing to contrast all these business entities with is the sole proprietorship. So in the absence of any business entity, an individual just conducting the business is considered a sole proprietor, and legally it has no identity separate from the business. The owner of that business has complete liability. There's nothing to form. There's no entities, no filings to make. They're just simply the proprietor of the business. They have absolute liability for themselves as well as their agents. So in that regard, a sole proprietorship is a very risky vehicle when dealing with business, especially if limited liability is a concern. Really, the only times I will typically see true sole proprietorships anymore, or we'll discuss general partnerships, will be if there's a in a licensed profession where you may be limited in the limited liability you can have for your professional malpractice. So it's not uncommon to see a lot of dentists, for example, that are actually still sole proprietors in their practice. Anything to...
So yeah, we're going to kind of go through, and Adam's going to give the basics for each one, and then I'm going to have some general concepts for each entity as it relates to bankruptcy, and really some of these can get pretty complex, so this is kind of the 10,000 feet above you, if you will. With the sole proprietorship, it's pretty straightforward. I haven't found one case that's held otherwise. They all held that the sole proprietorship cannot file bankruptcy itself. I'm not quite sure. If you look at 109, a debtor must be a person. A person under 10140 is defined to be a corporation. And a corporation under 10019A is defined to be an unincorporated company or association. And if you Google and do some quick definitional searches, a sole proprietorship always falls under an unincorporated company. I think more as a practical matter, as debtor's counsel, you would never want to file as a sole proprietorship because the individual is liable for the debts. And as a creditor, you would want to get the individual's assets as well. So despite the chance that a sole proprietorship could potentially file by itself under the code, I don't think as a practical matter that would ever happen. But typically speaking, for those reasons, the sole proprietorship is just going to be an individual bankruptcy, so all of your typical rules for the individual filing is going to apply. I think the one note is if you are filing for an individual that has a sole proprietorship, always be sure to include the sole proprietorship's assets in the schedules. There is a Seventh Circuit case here, the Harris case, in the notes. And that was actually a criminal prosecution for failure to disclose assets. Counsel tried to argue. I'm not quite sure exactly how they were going to get there, but essentially since the sole proprietorship was not its own separate entity but not the individual, when the assets were exchanged to sole proprietorship, they ceased to exist. Needless to say, the Seventh Circuit didn't buy that, and that person went to prison. So that I think the only two real notes are that perhaps a sole proprietorship could do its own bankruptcy, but nobody would probably want to, and always include the assets on the individual schedules. Otherwise, you just have your typical individual filing.
So again, the main contrast is that is a distinctly non-entity form of doing business. General partnership, very similar, although it is considered a form of business entity, even though it does not afford any limited liability, and in fact, worse than that, it expands the universe of liability if you are a true general partnership under 178. A partnership is essentially defined as two or more persons carry on as co-owners a business for profit. You can form a partnership by accident. You can also form a partnership just by operation of law. It's on balance a pretty poor vehicle from a limited liability standpoint because it's worse than a sole proprietor in that not only are you responsible for all of your own debts, liabilities, and negligence, as well as your agents, but also those that your partners may incur because all partners are considered agents of the partnership. So in that regard, it creates this very broad universe of potential liability where everyone's got authority to bind that partnership and trigger that liability for everyone. Some of these can be managed by agreements, through partnership agreements, through indemnities between the partners. But again, as between third parties, that's not going to be real satisfying.
So with the partnerships, whether it's a general partnership, limited liability, whatever form, there's kind of four general principles that, and these will apply equally to the other business entity forms, but differently. And again, these are kind of just the higher level things that I thought were perhaps more important to note. The first is that the partnership and the other entities are not going to be able to receive a Chapter 7 discharge. That's going to raise quite a few issues, but I think as a general matter, the general understanding is once the Chapter 7 is completed, the assets are liquidated, the entity ceases to exist. But the question always remains that you're going to have those debts that still outstand or that are outstanding, and what would happen if somebody tried to for whatever reason, put more property into the entity. But the general rule is you're not going to get your Chapter 7 discharge. The entity is not going to be able to file for bankruptcy under Chapter 13 due to the definition under Section 109. And then the two broader and perhaps more important concepts are the automatic stay and what will constitute estate property. The general rule is going to be that the automatic stay is not going to apply to the underlying individuals that form the entity. There are exceptions. You'll see in footnote 2, there's this doctrine of extraordinary circumstances. And basically, the courts will look, and if, as a practical matter, they find that although it's stated to be the property stated to be held by the individual, that it's actually corporate property, they'll say the automatic stay will apply to the individual. And also, if it's found to be the property's found to be necessary for the reorganization, they'll say the automatic stay applies. Otherwise, courts will use their powers under Section 105A to essentially extend the injunction when they see fit. But the general rule is going to be if you have the entity filing bankruptcy, the automatic stay is not going to preclude your efforts to collect debts from the individuals that make up the entity as long as you're going after property that is solely held by those individuals. Similarly, with the estate property, the general rule is going to be when the entity files for bankruptcy, the property held by the entity itself is property of the estate and will not extend to property that's held by the individual. And conversely, if the individual files, the underlying property that's owned by the entity will not be property of the individual debtor's estate. And essentially, we'll talk about some of these issues a little bit in more detail with charging orders and LLCs. But as a general matter, the trustee and the estate is just going to hold the reversionary interest or the value of whatever profits or distributions that the individual will be entitled to. And you also see it in the materials here, at least with partnerships, as what Adam was discussing as far as obligations being shared between partners, and sometimes the partners holding individual ownership rights. There are some cases that have held that in those contexts, if the partnership files for bankruptcy, the underlying property won't automatically be property of the state if all of the partners haven't joined. And I think in the Eighth Circuit case, that was mostly a situation where other partners were trying to squeeze out another partner, so that also had some underlying factual circumstances that perhaps were more equity than law. But
the next species of entity we're going to talk about is the limited liability partnership. And really, a limited liability partnership is essentially it is a partnership in all respects under 178. The critical difference being you make a registration, Form 602, to file as a limited liability partnership. And really what a limited liability partnership does is it creates a limited form of limited liability between the partners. So essentially a general partner in a LLP still remains fully liable for all of their own acts and omissions as well as those of agents that they control, but they are not responsible for the acts or omissions of their other partners. In that regard, there's really no reason not to file a limited liability partnership election if you're going to do a partnership. And honestly, I can't think that I've ever formed a general partnership on purpose in my practice. Again, for the most part, general partnership nowadays almost exists exclusively as a form of remedy where someone's trying to seek to impose a partnership by operational law or someone's trying to claim rights under that. But again, if you're actually going to go into business purposely as a partnership, an LLP is clearly the way to go because you can create that extra barrier of liability between the partners. Not to be confused with the LLP, limited liability partnership, is the limited partnership. This is formed under 179. And what a limited partnership is essentially a partnership that consists of two different classes of partners. There will be one or more general partners that have all of the same powers of a general partner in 178 that can have the authority to act on behalf of the partnership and take actions and have the full agency and management control. And then a group of limited partners who basically have investment interests. And by virtue of their fact that they have such limited powers and control, the statutes afford them very broad, limited liability. In fact, I'm not aware of, as long as you comply with the list of permitted management activities, which we're going to discuss a little bit in our second kind of second half of things when you talk about the different management powers. As long as you stay within the four corners of what you're allowed to do under the statute as a limited partner, the limited partners typically have absolute immunity. There's no veil-piercing theories in any cases that I have seen, unlike LLCs or partnerships or corporations, I should say, where mere investors could get tagged out. If you answer the description of a limited partner, really only your investment is at risk. In order to form a limited partnership, there's a you form a certificate of domestic limited partnership, Form 302, and again, you have to file a registration every year, and there's certain ongoing filings with the state. So it is a entity that you have to go out of your way to create. That's not going to happen by accident. There are filings to make, but this is a there's some other, in terms of other choice of entity reasons, there's also some tax reasons why people will choose the limited partnership form that are kind of beyond the scope here. But the main takeaway is limited partners have an almost absolute form of limited liability as long as they stay within their lane of permitted activities, whereas the general partners are, again, essentially general partners and have full liability for their acts. There is, not in Wisconsin, but in other states, there is such a thing as the LLLP, the Limited Liability Limited Partnership, which is essentially a limited partnership that has two or more general partners who have elected a limited liability partnership between them. We don't have that in Wisconsin. I think that may be in the offing, though, as part of the attempts to enact the revised Uniform Limited Partnership Act, but we don't have that at present. The next form of entity we'll be discussing is the business corporation under Chapter 180. Corporation, in contrast to a sole proprietorship or a general partnership, whether or not for-profit, will generally limit the liability of the shareholders to the extent of their investments. And that's by operation of statutes, which provide that, unless otherwise provided in the Articles of Incorporation, a shareholder is not personally liable for the acts or debts of the corporation, except that a shareholder may become personally liable if they act other than as a shareholder. Similarly, a purchaser from a corporation of the corporation's shares is not going to be liable to the corporation or its creditors with respect to the shares, except to pay the amount that it agreed to pay for the shares. So there's a fairly robust, what we call the corporate veil between the entity and its shareholders. There are certain circumstances where the shareholders will be found liable for corporate debts, and we call this piercing the veil. The tests can be a little vague sometimes in terms of their articulation, but are essentially boiled down to some form of what we call the alter ego or instrumentality test, where essentially the corporation is essentially found to be really nothing other than the acts of the shareholders and, again, consider the alter ego of the shareholders themselves. It can also happen when the corporation itself has been deemed to be undercapitalized. That is to say, the shareholders did not put enough actual capital in the company where it was reasonable for it to conduct its business or affairs at inception, or where the observance of the corporate form would promote injustice or sanction fraud. In terms of what's going to cause somebody to fall out of bed on those tests, the big ones are commingling of funds or assets, essentially failing to recognize a distinction between the finances of the corporation and those of its shareholders. So having separate bank accounts is pretty critical. Likewise, maintaining corporate records and complying with all the corporate formalities. You actually have to go ahead and form that entity. You can't just call yourself an Inc. You have to make all the appropriate registrations with the state DFI. You're supposed to have, in addition to the articles you file, bylaws, minutes, and otherwise follow all the formalities of the statute. There is one exception to that, which is the statutory close corporation. That is a subchapter under 180. It's under subchapter 18, so 180-1801. This was a kind of a sort of an election you can make. This was enacted first in 1989, and it essentially is meant for small corporations. It's got certain tests in terms of how many shareholders you can have, And essentially, if you make this election, which has to appear in your articles, you can essentially forego a number of the formalities. You don't have to have a board of directors. Your shareholders can essentially engage in all the actions of the business. There's not as much pressure to maintain bylaws or other corporate minutes. I've never actually formed a statutory close corp in my time. I've seen them. But I would say that by and large, they have been supplanted in practice by the limited liability company, which came about in 1993. Because you, especially since you know what we call the check the box rules, you can now really have a LLC that for tax purposes can either be a partnership disregarded or a corporation. I'm not aware of anybody that really wants to pursue the benefit. If you want that flexibility, most people will pursue that and make a corporate election than go with a statutory close corp. But it does exist as a form out there. But again, if you didn't check that box to make that election, your failure to follow those formalities could cause you to could cause the shareholders to experience a loss of limited liability. When it comes to undercapitalization as a measure, the important factor here is to figure out whether or not it was organized at the time with sufficient capital. So the test in most cases is whether or not you were adequately capitalized at inception, not necessarily whether or not you at all times had adequate capital. Again, a company could do very well one year and could wind up going into the red another year. That doesn't require the shareholders to put in additional capital. But at the outset, it should be adequately capitalized. And the inquiry here is to figure out, could the shareholders reasonably have anticipated that they would be unable to pay their debts when they first formed that? And, you know, things you look at there are, did they just put a bunch of loans in there? Did they, did they actually really put some skin in the game at the time they formed? And then domination and control of the entity. Corporations will pierce the veil when a shareholder who owns most of the stock so completely dominates the policy and practices that the corporation can be said to have no separate existence from its owners. And these get to be some funny and odd equitable tests more often than not. Courts can also ignore this corporate entity if it appears that it's being used to evade a statutory or contractual obligation.
So for the kind of the more procedural aspects of veil piercing in the bankruptcy, it should be accomplished through an adversary proceeding. And it's always going to be a creature of state law. So the principles that Adam just stated, of course, are specific to Wisconsin. So keep that in mind, depending on where your entity, where the individual comes from and the entity that you're trying to pierce the veil was incorporated under or otherwise created under. Then we have the whole issue with wellness and consent. I appreciate that consent can now be implied. You'll note in the materials I say you should be wary seeking the final judgment without express consent. Perhaps all of this has been remediated by the changes to Rules 7008 and 7012, but mostly that's just a reminder that consent's always going to be an issue, and I think the next two big issues as far as wellness goes is whether or not these corporate veil-piercing claims are stern claims, which is to say identified as core claims but otherwise unconstitutional, or if they're going to take Judge Roberts' position in the concurrence and say that, no, they're perfectly fine. And then the second issue being exactly what is consent and when it's implied. I don't have the case cited in here, but when wellness was still pending review by the Supreme Court, Judge Easterbrook actually had a case where he distinguished wellness, saying that in his circumstance there was waiver and not forfeiture. That seems to have kind of been blown over by the Supreme Court, but I think those are some issues that still may show up. So I think the big thing is it's adversary proceeding. Remember what state law that you're operating under, and then always be aware of the consent issue.
Couple other points to note when it comes to the corporate veil. It's a one-way set of liabilities. That is to say, the shareholders have an immunity from the debts of the corporation. The reverse isn't always true. That is to say, the shares are considered a security. If a shareholder has a debt to a creditor, those shares can be foreclosed on, and then those shares can wind up falling in the hands of the creditor. And unlike LLCs or partnerships, which we'll be covering with respect to what we call the charging order, essentially a creditor now becomes a shareholder of the company if they wind up taking the shareholder's shares. This could be particularly problematic in what we call small and closely held corporations where, you know, if you really don't want, if you have, three equal shareholders, you don't want to have the creditor of one of your, you know, shareholders essentially running one-third of your company because they've got, you know, certain voting rights. And so typically in the small and close-held business, there will be some sort of shareholder agreement that will get into, automatic redemption or cross-purchase that gets triggered in the event of the insolvency or bankruptcy of one of the shareholders. That's another way in which you can try to insulate the corporation from the debts of the shareholders. But again, it's kind of a one-way sort of limited liability. You really would like to, you know, be clear of the creditors coming in via your shareholders.
And just really quick, I forgot to mention, when you're piercing the veil in the bankruptcy, you also have to kind of evaluate what other effects it might have on your case, as especially from the creditor side. And the second footnote, there's a case, I think, from the District of New York, somewhere in New York. But essentially what happened was the creditor initiated a state court action against the individual, I think president or director, in five of his corporations. The individual files for bankruptcy. The bankruptcy court says that the automatic stay applies to the individual only and not the corporations, consistent with the general principle that we just discussed before. The state court proceeding continues. The creditor gets his judgments against all the state against all the corporations. The bankruptcy continues, and they pierce the corporate veil against the individual debtor. And without anybody asking it, the court on its own, it sua sponte says, well, now that we've pierced the corporate veil, all of those judgments are void ab initio. As a practical matter, maybe it doesn't matter because all of the assets are now part of the individual debtor's bankruptcy, but now maybe you're sharing them with other creditors. But just an example of where if you're going to try to take some of these tactics, you really kind of have to map it out and see what affects, because either nobody was thinking about it, but nobody certainly asked the court to do it, and it just did it on its own. So,
last piece to say on corporations and limited liability, it's relevant to a lot of folks here just by virtue of the fact that you're all lawyers. The service corporation, some of you may be at firms which are structured as service corporations. That's a species of business corporation, 180, that is limited to certain professions, licensed professions, the idea being that the entities used to not be able to engage in any kind of licensed profession. We created this special species of company that allows organizations, as long as they're owned and operated by all the same license holders, to conduct the licensed practice through the corporate form. One of the trade-offs for that, though, is the licensees do not have limited liability for their own professional acts and omissions. So if you're a doctor in a group practice or a lawyer in a law firm structured as a service corporation, you are fully liable personally for your own professional malpractice and acts and omissions, though not those of your partners. So in that respect, it's like the limited liability partnership. You have layers of liability between the partners, but not the partners themselves. The next form of entity, the non-stock corporation under 181, essentially, for all the purposes of limited liability, it's essentially the same as Chapter 180. It's very much a corporation. It's just got a different set of management and operational rights that are more attuned towards operation of a non-profit organization, or one where the owners can't have an interest in the underlying property. That brings us to a limited liability company under Chapter 183. Like a corporation, it affords a fair amount of limited liability to the members of that organization, the equivalent of the shareholders. For the most part, they will be only liable to the extent of their investment and will not typically be sued in their capacity as members as such, provided they do not run afoul of any of the fiduciary duty or torts or other things in a personal capacity. Pretty much all of the veil-piercing concepts that apply to corporations, though, have been incorporated into Chapter 183 by virtue of Section 183.0304 sub 2, which essentially incorporates all of those same doctrines in the business corporation context two LLCs. So all the same rule, you know, so again, you got to form your LLC. You can't just call yourself an LLC. You have to make the registration of the DFI. You should have a separate bank account. You should go through the formalities in terms of papering up, you know, things as being the actions of the members or the managers in their managerial capacity as opposed to the acts of the members personally. Before we get to the bankruptcy piece, but the unlike the corporate side, though, creditors here do not have the ability to automatically foreclose on the units or LLC membership interests of the members. Rather, what they can get is essentially what's called a charging order. They're essentially able to get what amounts to a transferee type interest. They can attempt to get all of the distributions day-to-day or distributions liquidation that that member would be entitled to, but they have no rights as a member to essentially vote or engage in the management of those actions. So that the limitation on the charging order. Now, there's been some back and forth amongst different jurisdictions as it relates to what we call the single member LLC. It used to be for many years in the first generation statutes that an LLC, like a partnership, had to have two or more members. Most of the later generation statutes provide you can have one member and still be a limited liability company. And in those contexts, a number of courts have looked at this and said, gee, what's the point of having the charging order here if there's only one member? Essentially, this looks this kind of smacks of a form of improper asset protection. But under the statute, the remedy here is the charging order, not just an actual ability to foreclose on the units and become the member.
Yeah. So I guess kind of going back and jumping ahead at the same time. Again, the same four general principles apply to the corporations and the LLCs. With the corporations, I will note that the issues with the automatic stay are also going to apply when you have the parent and the subsidiary company. So if the parent files, the subsidiary isn't necessarily going to be protected by the automatic stay and vice versa. And that's why you see in some of these larger cases, you'll have the parent and its 52 subsidiaries, and it's all consolidated into one case. For the LLC, the part that's jumping ahead, we have the bankruptcy authority cited on pages 40 and 41. But again, the overarching principle that if the individual files, that the property that's owned by the LLC will not be property of the estate still applies. However, with the single member LLC context, as Adam just noted, the courts have now shifted and started to say, but taking a step back, the real question is, does the trustee hold basically a charging order interest, which is basically an assignee entitled to any profits or distributions made by the LLC, or does the trustee obtain the membership and ownership rights that are part of the LLC under the operating agreement? And what the courts have started to say is that if it is a single member LLC, it's not just this charging order concept. They do obtain the ownership and managerial aspects. And although the underlying property is not technically estate property, the trustee controls the entity and can just liquidate it and then take all of the funds that that come from the liquidation. Otherwise, as a single member, I could just say, I'm not going to liquidate anything, so you get nothing. Now, as a practical matter, that may not seem to make much of a difference. If I can sell everything, what does it matter if the property is actually property of the estate? But you'll see the 2012 case, and Judge Kelly actually had a case in 2010 where it's actually going to have an impact on the exemptions that the debtor can take. Both of those, the 2012 and 2010 cases, both involved the homestead exemption. The home was owned by the entity. The debtor says, I should get the homestead exemption, and both courts said, no, look, you don't own it. It's not proper part of your bankruptcy estate, and therefore you can't get the exemption. But especially in the 2012 case, Judge Martin suggested that he would have followed this idea that the ownership rights and the right to control and sell the assets went into the estate, and the trustee held that power. And that didn't really play out because they just settled. So we didn't really get to see how that happened. So that's kind of the one wrinkle with the LLC is to what extent is the trustee going to have a control over the entity if it is just a single member LLC.
Right. I think where there's two or more partners, certainly it would appear that the it is going to be treated more like the partnership and that charging order respected. The last entity we'll cover just very briefly here is the, and this is one of the newer forms of entity, is called the Benefit Corporation. It is a construct of new Chapter 204. It is essentially a Chapter 180 business organization with the distinction that it is allowed to have a, through its articles, it can enact a, it can serve, quote-unquote, a general public benefit. It's basically an exception to concerns that somehow 180 enacted a shareholder primacy model where directors could only consider the interests of the shareholders and not any other constituencies. Now, frankly, I don't think that was accurate. Chapter 180 actually does have some language that provides that directors can consider other constituencies besides the shareholders, but other states were enacting them, so we decided to enact these as well. And so this would be, for example, an entity that is still a nominally a for-profit enterprise, but through its articles, again, wants to, you know, take into account, say, the interests of the environment or, you know, quasi-municipal bodies or the like. From a limited liability standpoint, it's still a Chapter 180 organization. I think one of the interesting questions that I think we haven't seen yet because they're brand new, but I think will start to arise is when we get into the area of fiduciary duties, who holds the duties and who gets to sue? Because once you've expanded the universe of who you owe a duty to beyond your shareholders, I think there'd be some knotty questions as to who stands in the shoes of these other constituencies. But from a just general liability of the owner's standpoint, a benefit corporation can have private shareholders, and they generally enjoy broad limited liability. You want to talk briefly about the bankruptcy remote entities?
Yeah, sure. So this seems to be more a creation of the common law and statute. And the basic concept is Corporation A will create Corporation B, and the sole purpose of Corporation B is to shield certain assets from a future bankruptcy by Corporation A. So putting aside, let's just assume that the timing and everything doesn't give rise to any kind of avoidance action. The typical circumstance is Corporation A creates Corporation B, sells all of its accounts receivables to Corporation B. If done correctly, Corporation B services and processes and takes all the profits from the accounts receivable. And then when Corporation A files for bankruptcy, the creditors can't get at any of the assets, profits, accounts receivable, et cetera, that's held by Corporation B. The direct issue as to whether or not these are enforceable has not necessarily been decided by the Seventh Circuit, but you'll see this I'll say LaSalle Bank case because I don't know how to say the first name. The LaSalle Bank case, in that case, it implicitly blessed this type of entity, remanded to the Northern District of Illinois. And the main point here is, in that case, it's citing United Airlines. And in United Airlines, the issue there was whether or not a lease was actually a lease or a security instrument. And the main point of United Airlines was, even though the document was called a lease, after giving an in-depth review of what the transaction actually entailed, the court concluded that it was actually a secured interest, and therefore the lease could not essentially be abandoned by the Chapter 11 debtor, and the creditor had a secured claim in that case. So the overarching point is, just because you call it something once you get to bankruptcy, it doesn't necessarily mean that that label's going to control. And that's going to be very important with these bankruptcy remote entities. On page 16, if you look in the third paragraph, just some of the examples that the district court looked at in that case are fairly intensive. And as you see, it goes all the way down to having different letterhead, et cetera. So while these are hypothetically possible, it is going to be a fairly intensive factual inquiry as to whether or not you successfully done it, and you may have some risk if you decide to go down this path.
Yeah, one of the friskier forms of these that I've seen in practice has been LLCs that purport to have what are called springing members, which is essentially someone who holds like a creditor-type position that upon the occurrence of certain events affecting the nominal existing member will spring into a membership interest and from that position, you know, attempt to, you know, redeem or otherwise exert ownership and control of the entity itself as opposed to, the current membership, kind of a way of taking almost like a secured position by taking ownership directly of the entity through this springing membership. I don't know that that kind of entity will work in Wisconsin under current Chapter 183, only because our current formulation does not seem to permit of any what I'm going to call non-economic membership interest. Generally, in order to be a member in Wisconsin, you have to make a contribution of capital or services of some sort. I've seen where you can have just merely a, as I said, a non-economic interest like that, where you're just called a member, just become a member. But I think that begets all sorts of knotty questions as to whether or not, again, whether or not that is a some sort of species of fraudulent conveyance, or whether there's adequate consideration for those interests that are, or for that security, I guess, that's being created through this springing membership. So that's kind of the survey from a what we call the limited liability standpoint of the owners vis-a-vis the entities itself. The second part we'd like to talk about for the second roughly one half here is to go through a discussion of the governance and fiduciary considerations between these forms, because now when you're in a creditor position, or it's good to understand how are these entities supposed to operate day to day, who has the right to make these judgments on behalf of the entity, to bind the entity, and what duties do those managers have, both to the members, if you're an investor seeking recovery, or to creditors even. And we'll talk about the Wisconsin's let's say unique in that regard when it comes to the prospect of fiduciary duty to creditors. So first, just as we did before, to contrast this to everything else that's going to be coming up, when we look at the sole proprietorship, the governance is as simple as can be. The owner runs the place. That's it. There's no officers, there's no boards, there's no fanciness. They want to do something, they do it. That's it. The owner runs it. Same with fiduciary duties. They're the sole owner. They really only have a duty to themselves. So there's nobody else to sue there. We have the general partnership. That's going to be run by all of the managers. All the partners in the state of nature. So under 178, you can roll your own to a large extent under the partnership agreement. But unless your partnership agreement provides otherwise, each partner has an equal right to participate in the management of the partnership. So if you want to, one person, one vote. If you want to change that, you need a partnership agreement that says, these partners don't vote, or these partners get X votes to my Y vote. But in the state of nature, it's one partner, one vote. As to certain extraordinary matters, those do require the approval of all of the partners. Generally speaking, it's a majority rule type concept in the ordinary course. So if it's an ordinary course action, the vote of the majority of the partners will bind the entity. But certain major transactions, such as an act that's outside the ordinary course, an amendment to the partnership agreement, or a merger, conversion, or the like, those will require unanimous consent. Again, unless you've altered that by operating agreement. When it comes to binding the partnership and dealing with third parties, in contrast to, say, a corporate shareholder who has no authority, of record, because they're merely a shareholder, they're not a director or officer, every partner of a partnership is an agent, and absent agreement to the contrary, they get to bind that partnership. They can go out to a third party, they can place an order, they can buy something, and that will be binding on the partnership. And all those partners also have what's called the apparent authority to govern the partnership. Under new RUPA, the Revised Uniform Partnership Act, which I think was enacted in 2016, we do have a mechanism called a statement of authority that can be recorded, and that's a way of essentially providing a firm notice as to who has authority to bind the partnership. But again, it's only going to be binding on it's going to be binding on folks who have actually received a copy of it or have actual knowledge of it. So in the ordinary course, you still have to worry that if somebody is called a partner and is a partner in your partnership, they may wind up binding the partnership to a parent authority. But if you give it to a vendor or this statement of authority, you can lock that down. The other big exception is when it comes to real estate. A partnership that has a filed statement of authority can only convey real estate as set forth in that statement of authority. There's no apparent authority to transfer real estate in that setting. With respect to fiduciary duties, each partner stands in a fiduciary relationship to all the other partners, and it's considered a very broad set of obligations. The duties of the partner are set out in 178, and they are to account to the partnership and to hold all property of the partnership essentially in trust, to refrain from having an adverse interest to the partnership, to refrain from competing with the partnership, and to generally discharge all of their obligations to the partnership in a manner that's consistent with good faith and fair dealing, which is sort of the standard implied in all contracts. Limited liability partnerships, basically, same exact set of rules. All an LLP does is create that those layers of limited liability. In all other respects, an LLP is a partnership subject to these same rules regarding management, authority, and the fiduciary duty between the partners. The limited partnership under 179, here we do see a significant difference, and there it's that the governance is vested solely in the general partners, whether one or more, and as between themselves, they'll act essentially through 178. So again, if there's three or four general partners, it'll be a set of majority issue, majority rule type concerns. Although in practice, you find that most LPs usually have like one general partner and then a series of limited partnerships, but you could have more than one general partner, and then all those same principles will apply, and the general partners have that same fiduciary duty not only amongst themselves, but to all their limited partners. Now, again, what makes the limited partners unique is that you have this kind of class of investors, the limited partners, that are supposed to have no significant management activity, and to the extent that they do, that's what will erode their right to the limited liability under the statute. And so one of the areas that becomes the knotty question is how much control can limited partners have in an entity? Section 179.23 sub 2 sets out some clarity as to what a partnership, what a limited partner can do without falling out of bed as a limited partner. And it can engage in it can vote on a number of matters, including dissolution of the business, sale or exchange of all the assets, the incurrence of debt other than the ordinary course, change in the nature of the business, removal of a general partner or admission of an additional general partner, removal or addition of other limited partners, approving conflict of interest transactions between the partnership and one of the partners, amending the LP agreement, or other kind of extraordinary matters that are set forth in the limited partnership agreement. So it's a fairly limited list of extraordinary transactions. They're not supposed to be engaged in the day-to-day affairs. Now, where it gets a little blurry is some of the dual roles that people can have. So, for example, it's also not a problem to engage in the following actions. A limited partner can be a contractor or agent of the limited partnership itself or of a general partner, and can even be a director or officer of a corporation that is the general partner or the manager of an LLC that's a general partner. So in practice, Joe Smith might be the limited partner and hold a limited partnership interest, but Joe Smith might also be the manager of the LLC that is the general partner. And so in that respect, it becomes a question of hats. Which hat are you wearing at the time you make those judgments? So when Joe Smith takes a decision, if it's clear that Joe Smith is acting as the manager of General Partner LLC, that's a perfectly permitted act, and he is not necessarily running afoul of his duties as a limited partner of the entity itself. But as you can see, it can get a little it can get a little gray there, and a limited partner would do very well to follow all those formalities to the letter and make sure you're very clear which hat you're wearing at the time. Otherwise, it could look for all the world like Joe Smith is actually engaged in the day-to-day decision-making and therefore not a limited partner. It's also not cheating for a limited partner to consult or have or advise a general partner with respect to the partnership's business. There again, it's a matter of authority. Joe Smith might not be the manager of the general partner LLC, but he could be a consultant. He could be advising the general partner. But the critical question is whether or not what Joe Smith has to say is that interesting information, or is it binding? And likewise, acting as a surety or guaranteeing obligations does not make you does not take you out of bed as a limited partner. So even though you the notion of being a limited partner is that you want that absolute limited liability, the fact that you might decide to a limited partner might decide to guarantee a lease or guarantee a loan doesn't otherwise change their status. They're only going to incur the personal liability for that guarantee that they choose to sign. So from a fiduciary duty standpoint, limited partners do not have any fiduciary obligation to each other or to the partnership itself. In that regard, they essentially act as what I'm going to call minority shareholders, regardless of what percentage they own. On business corporations, it's a far more centralized system of governance. Essentially, shareholders, they are the owners of the equity, of the principal, but they are not in control of the day-to-day. Rather, they elect the board of directors. The board of directors is the body that essentially dictates overall corporate policy and decision-making, though they don't implement it themselves. That falls to the officers that are appointed by the directors. And so, with the exception of the statutory close corp, all Chapter 180 business corporations have to have a board of directors, one or more, does not have to, have to can have one director, and must have at least three officer positions by statute: the president, the secretary, and the treasurer. You can also have one or more vice presidents. You can have one or more assistant officerial roles. But you, at a minimum, you will always have three statutory officer positions. And one of the things you have to worry about in practice is whether or not someone may have filed their articles of incorporation, but if they didn't actually follow any of the formalities, they're not electing a board, they're not electing officers, they're not setting that out in an annual report like they're supposed to be, that's where people can get in trouble and find themselves without the limited liability or some other claim against them, or finding that they have a fiduciary duty they didn't expect. Directors have a very broad directors and officers have a very broad set of fiduciary duties to the company. They're broken down into essentially the duty of care and the duty of loyalty. The duty of care is one that essentially says that the director is going to act with vigilance in all matters and exercise reasonable care in all of its decision making. You cannot escape that duty by simply saying you were a figurehead. You can't say, well, I'm the owner, or I'm not, I'm just the, they call me the president, but I'm not really the president. That doesn't work. If you're going to occupy that role, you are saddled with that duty. Most courts have enacted some species of what we call the business judgment rule that says, so long as the director does not engage in fraud or illegality and basically acts in good faith but just makes a mistake, that's okay. Business involves risk. You're allowed to take risks. You can be wrong. And as long as you're wrong within the ambit of good faith, that director is not personally going to be exposed, to the fact that there was a, I guess what I'm going to call, kind of a species of mere negligence in the tort parlance. But, it's okay to be wrong as long as you were thoughtful, as long as you took some care, and being reasonably diligent. Under Wisconsin law, directors and officers are not required to make firsthand investigations of every detail. You can rely upon your agents. You can rely upon your accountants. You can rely upon your attorneys. But again, it's a matter of a vigilance and attentiveness. You know, are you reading the reports? Are you making an informed judgment? If you don't go to meetings, you don't read financials, you don't read reports, that's what's going to cause you to lose the protection of the business judgment rule and find that you have failed in your duty of care. The duty of loyalty, likewise, you have a duty of loyalty to the corporation, all of its dealings, to promote its interests without regard for personal gain. Where we typically will see this in cases is in the context of conflicts and corporate opportunities. Basically, under conflicts of interest, if the corporation is going to do a business deal with a director or officer or an entity that they have an interest in, got to turn square corners. Fundamentally, you've got to disclose that to the other directors and let them act on that. Corporate opportunities, similar concept, essentially. If it's an opportunity that should have belonged to the corporation, like a lease or a property that the business wanted to acquire, you got to give the corporation first shot at getting at it. Non-stocks, basically same as for-profit corps, difference being that they don't always have shareholders or what we call members. LLCs, management can get a little tricky in that you have two flavors. I'm going to try to wrap this up quickly. Manager-managed and member-managed. Got to spell that out in the Articles of Incorporation. Where it can get a little naughty is where people set themselves up one way, then act as another, the vexed question of the managing member. But fundamentally, they have the same, more or less the same duties in the state of nature. By statute, we have set out under 183 a form of the duty of loyalty and the duty of care. So it's not a common law test. It's under the statute. But it can be modified by operating agreement. It can be reduced, but it cannot be reduced below the contractual duty of good faith and fair dealing. And with that as background, do you want to cover some of the fiduciary duties?
We're running out of time. So just real quick, typically only the trustee is going to have standing to bring these derivative actions for breach of fiduciary duties. The courts have started to expand that if the trustee is going to refuse to do so on behalf of the creditors. And then the typical with any fiduciary duty claim, if the creditor has its own separate harm, he or she can probably bring their own claim. But also appreciate that whether a fiduciary duty exists is going to be one of the exceptions where the bankruptcy law is going to control. So you're going to have to figure out whether or not Wisconsin law and all the principles Adam just discussed fall within that. And then really quick with the fraudulent conveyance and other avoidance considerations, just the general concept here is that same concept in American Airlines applies, that just because you give something the label of a loan or what have you, that's not going to control. And oftentimes we'll get clients to say, I want to do X, and I'll say, well, you can't do that because it's actually Y, and they'll say, well, let's just call it this and we'll be okay. You can't do that. And you see some of the examples in number 3 where they've tried to do that, or some of the other things that may not jump out as improper transfers, such as the avoidance of a pre-petition transfer of coal. And I think the other point is my role is kind of limited because, for the most part, a lot of these concepts are going to be controlled by state law. So just keep that in mind that obviously 541, for example, controls what's property of the state, but that's extremely broad, and it's any interest in property. And what that interest in property is going to be your state law. And remember what state you're in. Just because you have a case from Florida talking about partnerships doesn't mean that Florida's Partnership Act is the same as Wisconsin's.
Great. Thank you so much, guys. Judge Manning mentioned to me, these are fabulous materials. So those of you that are in our remote locations, remember, you can always find the materials on our website. If you couldn't make it today, I don't know why I'm talking to you, but there's a recording. There'll be a recording of the presentation along with the materials on the website. Stay tuned for what the next chapter of the Lou Jones Breakfast Club is going to be. It might involve lunch this time. We'll see. Hey. Thank you again for making this a successful program for all these years, and thank you again to our speakers for a great presentation.